out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday, the 13th of February, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. We would normally have Nat Danelaw here. He sends his apologies. He will be back next week. But we have got Florian Geyer here, who stepped in at the last minute. I am so grateful. Florian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, everything considered, Sven. It's an honor to be on the podcast, as always.
Good, good. Well, we've got lots of interesting subjects to talk about today. We've got four subjects to try and get into. We've got Labour banning straight white males from attending one of their meetings. We've got Jews making up laws to say that they don't need equality or human rights law in their country if it comes down to it. We've got jets being shot down, Israeli jets being shot down by Syria. And we've also got Amber Rudd's new app for detecting extremist content online. So we've got a lot to get into, and I think we'll start with Labour banning straight white males from going to a meeting. Labour has defended its decision to ban straight white able-bodied men from its equalities conference just weeks after the party was found guilty of unlawful discrimination in a separate race row. A letter issued by Young Labour inviting supporters to apply for tickets states that the one-day conference in March is open only to under-27s who self-define as women, black, Asian and minority ethnic, LGBT or disabled. Well, I guess we can be thankful they haven't got paedophile there at the end of LGBT. While Conservative MPs slammed the move, a Labour spokesman said, "There was nothing new about spaces for people with protected characteristics meeting to discuss the inequalities and obstacles they face." James Cleverly, a black Tory, said, "It is essential that political parties represent each other and every person, irrespective of race, sexuality or age. The Labour Party should take action now to ensure that this discrimination comes to an end." After Conservative MP Ben Bradley took to Twitter to decry the policy, an account representing young Labour women mocked the Mansfield parliamentarian in a tweet asking sarcastically, "Will nobody think of the straight white men?" Last month, the party was forced to back away from ticket pricing, which charged white Labour activists and supporters £10 more than people with black and minority ethnic backgrounds. After the Equality and Human Rights Commission judged the racial surcharge to be unlawful. As was previously reported, Leicestershire Police declined to investigate Labour's anti-white price structure, despite thousands of people contacting the force to point out United Kingdom equalities legislation appears to outlaw providing goods, facilities or services on different terms on the basis of ethnicity. The perceived indifference of Leicestershire Police to the case prompted social media users to speak out against what they presumed to be double standards, suggesting authorities would have come down hard on any event which offered favourable pricing to white people. Well, of course they would have come down on it. We know white people aren't allowed to organise. I was talking about this just the other day with Nat Danelaw about the right to associate with who you want to associate with, the right to organise on ethnicity, and that's the very right that this Labour spokesman is using, where he's saying there's nothing new about spaces for people with protected characteristics meeting to discuss the inequalities they face. What he's trying to cite there is the right to associate with who you like, but we don't have that as white people. How can they exclude white people whose country it is from going to a Labour meeting? and the police just have no interest in it. This is a complete double standard, I think, Florian.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that is the most odious piece for most people that look at the story or observe the situation is the double standard. Especially Anglo-white people despise such regulation. I mean, we have a very long history of the rule of law, of objective morality, of objective legal standards, and that the legal principles are meant to be taken seriously and applied effectively and equally by the regime. Of course, it will come to none of the listeners of this podcast that that's not the case, and in fact, the opposite has been institutionally enthroned in the United Kingdom to our great woe and misfortune. And so what we're seeing is indeed the vanguard of the left, unfortunately, in this case, the Labour Party, who at one time at least had pretenses of standing up for labor. They have, they're basically making an attempt to normalize the wholesale discrimination against white men. We've seen this projected subtly and non-overtly through the soft power of the media, of ideologues for years and years and years. But now it's come to a head where, you know, one of the main two political parties in the United Kingdom is openly discriminating against straight white men in the country of their indigenous ancestry. And so most people on the surface understand that element of it, and they see that this double standard is unjust on a fundamental level. But I think that the people have often pointed out, like, the lamentable state is that, I mean, at one point, you know, our enemies, Marxists, the Labour Party socialists, they had pretenses, at least, of having a fig for labor, of standing up for the white working man. We've seen this all throughout the Anglosphere, is that there was, in fact, a historical tradition of white labor activism against capitalist and moneyed elite exploitation. And so, but what we've seen, unfortunately, is that without a fully fleshed out worldview behind such grievances to guide that that force, it is just co-opted in the long run for the service of the regime. And that the Labour Party never had, and certainly in the modern times, reveals that it does not have anything to do with labor in the slightest.
Well, they're just mocking white males. They used to claim that they supported the white working class, but the Labour spokesman there is mocking white people. And even the Conservative Party are too frightened to actually have a white man speaking up for us. They've got a black Conservative Party minister that says, oh, this is not right, this is discrimination. And it was exactly the same last time when we reported on the Labour Party having a conference and offering the cheap seats to Negroes. And once again, the Conservative Party, the voice for the Conservative Party was a black Tory. So on the one hand, you've got a party which is discriminating against whites by saying they can't come to the meeting. And then on the other hand, you've got a party who has already done the discrimination against whites and replaced whites with a Negro. And then you've got him arguing for us. It's absolutely ridiculous. And while this is going on over in Israel, they are quite openly making laws to keep the place white. Jews are over there, they've made a new law to keep Israel a Jewish state, regardless of human rights and equality law. So this is right at the highest level of the Israeli state, this is going on. Minister Eilat Shakid addressed the proposed nation-state law, contending that Israel as a Jewish state must administer equal civil, but not national rights. Justice Minister Eilat Shakid said Monday that if not for the fence erected some years ago on the Egyptian border, we would be seeing here a kind of creeping conquest from Africa. The fence effectively stopped asylum seekers from Sudan and Eritrea from entering the country. In a speech to the Congress on Judaism and democracy, Shakid also said, I think that Judaizing the Galilee is not an offensive term. We used to talk like that. In recent years, we've stopped talking like that. I think it's legitimate without violating the full rights of the Arab residents of Israel. Well, that's the equivalent of us in Britain talking about whitening London. Let's turn London white again. You can just imagine the government saying that. Continuing the article, on the coalition's intent to keep the word equality out of the nation-state bill, Shakid said, Israel is a Jewish state. It isn't a state of all its nations. That is, equal rights to all citizens, but not equal national rights. Shaqid said the word equality was very general and the court could take it very far, adding, there are places where the character of the State of Israel as a Jewish state must be maintained, and this sometimes comes at the expense of equality. Shaqid said the nation-state bill did not deal with the issue of who is a Jew. Everyone has his own Judaism. In the nation-state bill, when it talks about a Jew, it means the nationality. Shaqid then referred to the Qatadan ruling and said that if such a case were to come up again, or the argument over whether it's all right for a Jewish community to, by definition, be only Jewish, I want the answer to be, yes, it's all right. So, well, that, if the boot was to be on the other foot, that would be saying, in Britain, you have to be British, and that has to be ethnically British. And anybody else here, they can be a citizen, but they cannot be a national. So there will be different laws for British people than there are for anybody else that is here. And we certainly don't want equality with any of the other people here. It's absolute hypocrisy when you think that the main advocates for human rights and equality law and multiculturalism are all Jews when they're in our countries, but when they're in their own country, they're quite open about how we need this fence, we need to keep the Negroes out, and we need to change the law so that we remove all traces of the word equality from it. I mean, I have to hand it to these Israelis, it's a very, very sensible law. If they weren't in our countries arguing for the opposite, I would be quite happy with this. What are your thoughts on it, Florin?
Yeah, I agree with that precisely. If we come back to it, I think that the double standard here is the most overt layer of the kind of Jewish chutzpah and the global regime. And it's that particular tip of the iceberg, so to speak, that alerts most people on a base level who are not initiated into the ridiculousness of the situation. I mean, because they can see very clearly, it's nationalism for me and not for thee, as the expression goes. And so, I mean, there's a whole bunch of ways that we could talk about what this means, but it's, as you say, these Jews consistently, in the rest of the world, either exclusively promote the interests of Israel to the detriment of the nations that they're, the host nations that they reside in, or if they oppose Israel, they're also universally opposed to any nation states whatsoever, and advocate a global cosmopolitanism based around essentially money and materialism. And we've seen this consistently, and it's well documented and so on. So I guess that this is the difficulty, is that, you know, if this was a equally applied principle, you know, it's impossible not to deny, Jews want to live in their own Jewish neighborhoods and do their Jewish things in some other place. That's fine with me. But of course, we know that it is chutzpah, it is hypocrisy, that these Jews brazenly will demand and assert these rights for themselves, but in the same breath, out of the other side of their mouth, scream bloody murder when whites attempt to do precisely the same with their own communities. And they do this knowing full well the double standard, but they don't care. So sometimes it's almost difficult to find what depths to probe into these articles, because the hypocrisy is so blatant. The double standard, the dual law code, the one attitude for the goyim and one attitude for, you know, Israel is so apparent and so clear in their actions that it almost needs no explanation or dissertation.
Well, they expect to be nationals of everywhere else, don't they? The international Jew, the French Jew, the British Jew, the German Jew, they expect to be given those privileges wherever they go. And yet in their own country, oh no, we're not letting anybody else have that privilege. Everyone else can just be citizens, and only Jews can be nationals. I mean, they're quite open about being nationalist. And yet they attack it everywhere else. And yeah, I mean, we can stay on this subject of Israel, because the next article we've got here is about jihadis showing open support for Israel. And this is to do with this plane that's been shot down that I know you're going to go into in a bit, Florin. But I'll just read out this quote of what the jihadis have been saying. In a rare public expression of support for Israel, it's not rare, is it? The Islamists are always echoing support for Israel. In a rare public expression of support for Israel by a radical Islamist figure in Syria, a former leader in al-Qaeda's Syrian militia on Saturday welcomed Israeli airstrikes against Syrian and Iranian targets in the country after an Iranian drone infiltrated Israeli airspace and called on the Jewish state to quickly uproot Iran from its northern neighbour. "We welcome any Israeli aerial or naval bombardment against the Syrian regime and Iran in Syria. We urge them to do more. And we say to Israel, your silence over Iran's intervention in Syria will turn against you. It is inevitable. Act with haste to uproot them," Sally Al-Hamwi wrote on Twitter. Hamwi was a founder of the Nusra Front in 2012. In July 2015, the jihadist group said it dismissed him for not falling in line with the group's internal politics. He is now reportedly affiliated with the hardline Islamist group Ahrar al-Sham, and he's on Twitter. We've just been told about here in Britain about, oh, we must get all these extremists off of Twitter. We can't have them on Facebook. And yet here you've got a newspaper article that is taken from one of these jihadis that goes out and kills people, and he's still there on Twitter. These are groups that blow themselves up, use little children for assassins, do all sorts of sick things, even cannibal rituals with their victims. That's what this al-Nusra Front do. And this guy is still on Twitter. There's no mention of, oh, he should be banned from Twitter. Let's just give him a full-page article because he supports Israel. Tell us some more about this, Florin. Tell us some more about the background of this shooting down of the plane and your thoughts on this.
Indeed. We can come back to the fact that, al-Nusra Front was originally founded as al-Qaeda in Syria and was explicitly understood to be essentially the Syrian branch affiliate of al-Qaeda. Now, for our listeners who are learned in the history of the United States interference and geopolitics in the Middle East, they will know that al-Qaeda and the Taliban were set up with the help of the CIA, and that they were funded and backed by Saudi oil money for these Sunni radical extremist groups. And the great irony is when the conflict arose and began in Syria in 2012, al-Nusra Front was on the United States, U.S. State Department's list of proscribed terrorist organizations, which would mean that it's illegal. It's considered to be an act of terrorism, aiding and abetting terrorism or treason, to provide any material support or comfort to one of these groups. Yet that is precisely what Obama and the Hillary Clinton and even Donald Trump and the U.S. regime continues to do, is they continue by their own definition, by the United States' own internal definition, to engage in treason by supporting enemies that they themselves have prescribed as combatants against the United States and her interests. And so it's no surprise to me, because there's a long history of Salafist groups, of radical Sunnis being used as fronts and as agents of the Western powers, of the Zionist Anglo-moneyed elite, whether it's, everybody should be familiar with Lawrence and Arabia, about how when they were fighting the Ottoman Turks, they funded all of these mujahideen in order to destabilize and rile up all of the Arabs through Islamic fundamentalist preaching in the Saudi Peninsula and in other parts of the Turkish Empire. And so they have, it's long established, and they have no qualms about doing such a thing. And so the fact that a U.S.-backed, Salafist group in Syria fighting against the Bashar al-Assad regime, protector of Christians, famously, it should come as no surprise to us. I mean, there are stories of Israel giving medical aid and treatment to ISIS fighters in their hospitals. And ISIS, for a long time, had been occupying the Syrian part of the Golan Heights, yet we saw no Israeli action against their military presence. It really kind of makes you think. It really makes you think.
I'm sure, I think it may have been the foreign minister that said that Israel would prefer to have ISIS running Syria, and they would much prefer that to Bashar al-Assad. They're quite open about their support for them. You're right about the links going back years. I mean, you can go back to the 80s with Ronald Reagan, with the Mujahideen that were there. And they funded the start of al-Qaeda. And then, since 9/11, they've had this pretense of going against al-Qaeda. But once they pretended to get rid of Osama bin Laden, it was, right, we can support these guys again now. We'll support them in Libya. will get Saeed Gaddafi to let them all out of prison with a fake letter saying that they're no longer going to follow Islam. They're just going to follow the UK moderate version of it. And as soon as Saeed Gaddafi had let them out of prison, of course, they went to war against Gaddafi with funding from America. All the weapons were sent to them in Libya. As soon as they'd sodomized and butchered Gaddafi, they went straight off over to Syria and have been fighting in Syria ever since against Bashar al-Assad. And because of the propaganda that they've put out, America has had to make a pretense of going after these ISIS groups. But it wasn't until Putin went in there that he really put pay to them. And one of the things that really surprised me, Florian, is that Donald Trump seems to be trying to take credit for getting rid of ISIS over there when he had nothing to do with it. It was Putin that got rid of ISIS over there. America just left them. They gave announcements that they were going to go into one of these Iraq cities because they took over Iraq as well, and then left it 6 months before doing anything. If it was up to America, there would just be all these Islamist groups taking out Bashar al-Assad. I mean, on top of this, you've also got the Kurds that have been funded by America that are terrorists, according to Turkey. You've got Turkey that's taken out one of these areas that's got the Kurds in northern Syria. But one of the next area that Turkey is going to go to has also got Americans in it. It's the part of Syria where the Americans have a makeshift base. And that's the next part that they're going to go in to get these Kurds. And then at the other end of Syria, you've got Israel going in there, bombing the place, which is why they shot down this plane, which, you know, I mean, it's wonderful that they shot down this plane. There's been cheers all over the Middle East that finally an Israeli plane has been shot down. And I believe Iran has said that if there's any more excursions, they're going to do the same again. Do you know anything about the background to this? So this plane that was shot down, Florian?
Right. Well, my understanding is that what was going on is the so this is from The Guardian. Israel has launched what it described as a large-scale air raid in Syria after one of its F-16 fighters crashed while under Syrian anti-aircraft fire. The F-16 was shot at as it returned Saturday morning from a raid to destroy Iranian facilities accused of launching a drone into Israel. Both pilots managed to eject and landed in Israel. One was badly injured, and we actually later found out that one died. So essentially, to put it into perspective, Israel was flying its planes through Syrian military airspace, most of which is an active combat zone at the moment, in order to illegally, against the laws, it's illegal for them to be in their airspace to begin with, and it's also illegal to engage in military action against a target without declaring a state of war to bomb Iranian facilities in their own sovereign territory, right? And so as it comes back through Syrian territory, the Syrian government, quite rightly, defends its airspace and shoots down this Israeli jet. The Jews then lose their minds, of course, and proceed to engage in a large-scale bombing of Syrian military targets outside of Damascus. And so we've talked about on the show before chutzpah, the Jewish chutzpah. The very famous example that I've used is, you know, a Jewish man murders his parents, and then in court, he asks the court to have clemency because he's now an orphan. And that's essentially what has occurred, is the Jews have gone out and done a whole bunch of criminal actions. You know, it's like if you walk into somebody's house and, you know, you slap, you know, the father of the household because you're enemies with this father's friend. And then when the father kicks you out, you come back and murder his whole family and say, oh, well, you shouldn't have slapped me. I have every right to be in there. This is essentially the same circumstances that, you know, and then the Jews, of course, they cry out in pain as they strike you. I mean, they speak of, oh, we're just engaging in defensive actions. Well, we have to defend Israel's territorial sovereignty. And so, indeed, I mean, we come back to the theme of the show seems to be the double standards of Jewish behavior with their own people and with their enemies. And so the Jews certainly consider they don't obey any laws of war when dealing with Arabs. Any Arab regime, or Persian regime by that matter, that has the grit to stand up to the Zionist state, we see how they're treated. Yet, very curiously, coming back to this double standard, all of these supposed radical Salafist Muslims that want to, you know, kill every Jew and are the modus, the casus belli, so to speak, for, you know, unlimited support for the Israeli state, these ravenous, bloodthirsty, you know, Muslim terrorists that we're told are so nasty to these Jews actually are in support of the actions of the Zionist regime and received comfort and aid from the Zionist regime in order to oppose the Ba'athist, essentially Arab National Socialist State in Syria.
Well, it's an act of war for Israel to go in there. And I've lost count of the amount of times that they've sent jets into Syria and started bombing places. I mean, when it first happened at the start of the troubles in Syria, it was like, oh, what's going to happen? Is Bashar al-Assad going to respond? And then it was like, well, he's got to be patient and he's not going to respond, even though this is an act of war. And we've got to have respect for him for not starting a war in the Middle East each time Israel goes in there and does this. But as I say, I've lost count of the amount of times Israel's done it. And every single time it's an act of war. It's the start of a war. And now finally, Syria has paid them back. So finally, they've got a bloodied nose for going in there and bullying Bashar al-Assad. So it's going to be very interesting to see whether they go on any more raids into Syria. And if they do, I hope that Assad does get them back, because he's got Russia and Iran on their side now, and I think there will be pressure put on Israel to stop doing it. Otherwise, they could start up a world war. But the final story that I've got here for us today, and this is quite an interesting one, I think. This is Amber Rudd, the loathsome Home Secretary in Britain. She's developed an app to detect extremists, but it only works for Muslims. This is the surprising thing. You hear about it and you think, oh, well, this is something that's going to get rid of white nationalist stuff as well. But apparently not. It only works for Muslims. And I think I know why that is. I'll just read the quote. The UK government has unveiled a tool, it says, can accurately detect jihadist content and block it from being viewed. Home Secretary Amber Rudd told the BBC she would not rule out forcing technology companies to use it by law. Mrs. Rudd is visiting the US to meet tech companies to discuss the idea, as well as other efforts to tackle extremism. Thousands of hours of content posted by the Islamic State group was run past the tool in order to train it to automatically spot extremist material. The government provided £600,000 worth of public funds towards the creation of the tool by an artificial intelligence company based in London. ASI Data Science said the software can be configured to detect 94% of ISIS video uploads. Anything the software identifies as potential ISIS material would be flagged up for a human decision to then be taken. In London, reporters were given an off-the-record briefing detailing how ASI's software worked, but were asked not to share its precise methodology. However, in simple terms, it is an algorithm that draws on characteristics typical of ISIS and its online activity. I wonder just what the characteristics of ISIS are that it's picking up on. It couldn't be that it's picking up on brown people with masks on, could it? Because that would be racial profiling, wouldn't it, Florian?
Indeed, it would be racial profiling. It would be racial profiling.
They couldn't do that. They couldn't do that. They certainly couldn't be doing that, could they? I mean, £600,000 for racial profiling. I'm sure some of us could have written a bit of software that was going to flag up as soon as it had Muslims on it on a video.
Yeah.
That's got to be all it is. I mean,
you have to wonder what kind of behind-the-strings relationships here exist that justify the dispersal of £600,000 for essentially this totally frivolous piece of software. To me, it seems more like a good excuse to write, you know, a story, you know, demonstrating the government's efforts to combat radical Islam. You know, it sort of cost £600,000 for a PR event rather than any sort of implementable policy change. Because we know, as we've just covered, you know, they can't even keep, and there is no will to keep Salafists and radical jihadists off of Twitter. But there's all the will in the world to keep white identity activists, to keep national socialists, to keep any nationalists of any stripe, people to the right wing of Bernie Sanders, off of Twitter and social media.
I think they'd have problems trying to, you know, sort of racially profile us or try to work out, you know, some kind of algorithm on our videos, because it's all to do with common current events. So what are they going to pick up on? They can't. And it would flag up lots of mainstream news stories as well. So it's got to be the only thing they could have used is the fact that this is Muslims. And that's why they can't say anything about it. I think it's quite hilarious. Yes, I don't think it's anything to be worried about anyway. It just shows you how weak Amber Rudd really is to think that she can make some kind of app that will be able to tell extremism. It's just racial profiling. Simple as that. And that's all we need to do to get rid of jihadis at airports is look for the brown people. It's not going to be white people blowing up planes. Anyway, Florian, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Thank you very much for coming on today. I'll be back tomorrow with Booty Roper. God bless and hail victory.